In order to work out coherent recovery and reconstruction plans, and systematically and with sustained rather than ad hoc attention, ensure the implementation of those plans. So far, so good, but what was left unresolved, and hopefully will still be negotiated by the end of this year, was the actual detailed composition of this new body and the question of its relationship to either the Security Council, which is much to be preferred, or to ECOSOC, or to both of them for that matter. So far, so good on that stuff, but much to be done to translate it into operational effectiveness. Second set of issues on the peace agenda, on which, by contrast, the news is absolutely the worst, is disarmament and non-proliferation. What's needed, clearly, is action, both on the supply side, in order to constrain the availability of fissile material and the like, and on the demand side, to reduce countries' motivations for acquiring weapons of mass destruction, by addressing everything from real security threats to perceived double standards in arms control regimes. But what happened is neither of those things. There was no sign at the NPT review conference, Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty conference earlier this year, of any agreement whatever on any of the big four activities that were crying out for shutdown by mutual consent if a new cascade of proliferation was to be avoided. Nuclear testing, that's to say, new and continuing weapons programs, reprocessing, or uranium enrichment. And when it came to the summit, that glorious record of the NPT review conference was gloriously or ingloriously maintained. No agreement whatever could be reached on any one of those issues. And as a result, the summit outcome document says absolutely nothing about anything to do with weapons of mass destruction, arms control, disarmament. The page is a complete blank. The third security issue, which was the subject matter of the summit and all the argument in the lead up to it, was confronting terrorism, where the perceived need here was essentially twofold. First of all, to embrace a broad-based policy response going beyond intelligence and policing, and in extreme cases, military cooperation and action, to actually addressing root causes, including but not confined to political grievances. And the other critical need was to find common cause at last on an agreed international definition of terrorism, making attacks against civilians as indefensible in the 21st century as piracy and slavery became in the 19th. In the event, a little bit of lip service was paid to the first of those two objectives, with the General Assembly, God help us, given a mandate to come up with a comprehensive strategy document at some stage in the future. But on the second issue, that of the definition, the leaders went no further than to condemn terrorism in all its forms and manifestations. That's what we got out of them. Absolutely shirking the crucial norm-setting task of saying that that particular form, any form of violence against civilians, whatever the context, was absolutely prohibited. That's what was required, that's what didn't happen. The fourth big issue in the security basket was reforming the rules, or restating, redefining the rules, the principles governing the use of military force. What was proposed, and again my panel had a lot to do with this, was a set of guidelines for the Security Council identifying criteria for legitimacy, such as the magnitude of the threat, the idea of force being only a last resort, proportionality of response, and the need for any such action to actually do more net good than harm. This objective of getting agreed guidelines of that kind ended up being killed comprehensively by a combination of resistance on the one hand from the United States to having any guidelines at all which might constrain the Security Council's and by extension its own freedom of action, and on the other hand some not entirely intelligible arguments from some on the other side that to have any principles at all laid out purporting to limit the use of force to exceptional, highly defensible cases would be somehow to encourage the use of force on a greater scale than would otherwise have been the case. So much then for the outcomes on the pure security issues. On the human rights issues, the first big question was the creation of a new Human Rights Council to replace the totally dysfunctional Commission on Human Rights with a less politicized, more professional body actually committed to advancing human rights and not defending the indefensible. This became a very talismanic issue for the United States, which didn't help enormously its acceptance elsewhere. But the idea was a perfectly credible one, to have a smaller body elected by a two-thirds majority of the General Assembly in a way that would, that was hoped would exclude at least the worst human rights violators from actual membership of the Commission. But what happened was that a very fierce rearguard action was fought by a group of countries, Pakistan, Egypt, Iran, Syria, Uzbekistan and Cuba, prominent among them, who blocked every attempt to reach agreement on the structure, the mandate, the mode of operation of the new body. In the event, in the final wrap-up, last-minute all-night negotiating sessions, there was agreement to create a new council, but every issue of detail about where it would be located and what would be its composition and how it would be elected and what its mandate would be and so on, was left completely unresolved and subject to further negotiation. Better agreement on the human rights front was the agreement to double the resources and to available to and to approve a new action plan for the High Commissioner on Human Rights, the, not the Commission, but the Commissioner, a separate UN agency. The Canadian former judge Louise Arbour, who's a terrifically feisty, impressive woman and intensely lobbied for by her, and I really do think the availability of new resources for her and her office will make a real difference in what's actually achieved in a lot of human rights situations around the world. But the best news, I think, on the human rights front, and along really with the Peace Building Commission, probably the best news of the entire summit, was the leaders' endorsement of the principle of the responsibility to protect. I have to say something very dear to my own heart personally as one of the original architects of this concept in a Canadian Commission report that I co-chaired. The issue here, which was probably, you'll remember, the biggest one of all throughout the 90s in international relations, with the Balkans Wars and Rwanda in particular burned in our memory, the issue is how to respond effectively to genocide, ethnic cleansing, and similar massive human rights violations within states, within the boundaries of states, the issue of so-called humanitarian intervention. The core idea, which was endorsed by the leaders at this summit, but only, I have to say, after a very fierce rearguard action from a small group of developing countries joined by Russia, who basically refused to concede any kind of limitation at all on the full and untrammeled exercise of state sovereignty, however irresponsible that exercise might be. The core idea which was endorsed after that, notwithstanding that, was that state sovereignty does carry with it responsibilities as well as rights. And that while the primary responsibility for protecting its own people from avoidable man-made catastrophe does continue to rest with the sovereign state itself, if that responsibility is abdicated through either incapacity or through ill will, then the responsibility to protect shifts to the wider international community, which then has the responsibility to react, including, but only as a last resort, by military intervention, if that's authorised by the Security Council. Now, getting that little bundle of propositions actually endorsed unanimously by the 150-plus world leaders assembled in New York, getting accepted, in effect, a new international norm and creating a consensus where absolutely none existed in the 1990s on this issue, should, I think, be hugely helpful in generating consensus for action in the future when some new Rwanda or Bosnia or Kosovo comes along, as I fear it all too inevitably will. Final bundle of issues relates to institutional architecture. And in addition to the issue of the Peace Building Commission and the Human Rights Council that I've already mentioned, I think there are three other particularly crucial institutional reform issues on the table for the summit. The first was far-reaching administrative reform within the UN system, focusing on the Secretariat, but also the UN system, all those programs and agencies generally as well. Central issues argued for here were essentially a combination of greater empowerment associated with greater accountability.